The Athletic.
Totally Football Show today. All square at Old Trafford between Man United and Spurs. Elsewhere, Man City are box office and have an Oscar from the Academy. Friday night, there was Luton and Burnley and maybe a robbery too. We'll be talking about all those stories, plus Dai Young, the man who bled Reading like the Red Wedding, and Jadon Sancho's back, and maybe FFP penalties are too. It's all in the Totally Football Show. Sunday the 14th of January. Listener, hello and welcome to the show. It's, as I say, Sunday. It's late. We've just had Man United Spurs. We've got Colin Miller and Tim Spears here in the studio. Hello to you both.
Hi, James.
Good. Still alive. Nice. And also joining us, having just trekked his way back from the game of the weekend, Everton-Aston Villa, Daniel Story. All right, Daniel.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to leave that game.
Yes. Yeah. That was one of just five matches, as you know, listener, across this Premier League weekend. Just half a round being played this time, the other half coming up next weekend. Friday night, Burnley Luton ended 1-1 amid many grumbles from the home supporters at Turf Moor. Saturday, the worst run against a single opponent in English football history continued as Fulham lost again to Chelsea. Haven't won at Stamford Bridge since 1979, Costas. Chelsea, meanwhile, with their fourth win in five. Tea time on Saturday, Man City had that remarkable 3-2 game against Newcastle. Then on Sunday, Daniel's match, Everton-Aston Villa, no goals whatsoever. And four goals shared between the two teams at Old Trafford as Man United met Tottenham. It is, listener, with Spurs and the point earned away to Man United that we begin. Here's a bit of commentary.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Delivery. Werner and Bentancur! 50 seconds into the second half has rifled Tottenham level.
Well, that sets the tone there, doesn't it? 2-2. Colin, you were saying as the kind of second half wound its way towards a finale, and the stadium got progressively quieter and quieter, that actually not too much happened in that game.
Yeah, it was a really strange 2-2. I think the atmosphere, certainly in the second half, seemed to be quite notably flat. And maybe that's a little bit odd in the sense that United's sort of last big Premier League home game was that rousing comeback against Aston Villa on Boxing Day. But it didn't really seem like that was ever on the cards in this one. Tottenham were the better team. They had 63% possession. They had six shots on target. United only had the two, from which they were both very good finishes, from which they scored. But yeah, this is a tale of two teams who've been missing quite a significant number of players each through injury. But Tottenham and Ange Postecoglou seem to have dealt with it much better than United and Erik ten Hag have. And I think you could just see that throughout this game, that they were a team who played with a much better identity and a much better shape. That they, if there was one team that was going to win, it seemed that they would be the one to do it, albeit Scott McTominay.
Spurs, who had Romero and Van de Ven both back, and Timo Werner make his debut, Rado Dragosin coming on late on as well. Tim, how did you feel about Spurs performing still without Son and Kulusevski and Maddison, of course?
Yeah, I mean, we expected a lot of the game. You rarely get a dull game when Spurs are involved, and you rarely get a game where there isn't something going on in terms of Man United and their narratives. And I guess it kind of went to plan, really. It was a decent watch. It was an entertaining game. There were quite a few goals, a couple of attempts off the bar, nearly no goal, and then United nearly won it through a moment, which I guess was the only way they were going to. From a Spurs point of view, I thought, yeah, considering they looked much further ahead than Man United in their sort of evolution.
Well, their manager's been there so much longer, of course.
And as you mentioned, you know, that's despite so many, I mean, almost half the team still missing, despite the fact that Romero and Van de Ven were back for this one, and Van de Ven makes such a difference. He was a little bit rusty on occasion and he went off with cramp, but he still saved Spurs from a couple of certain very good chances that would fall in United's way with his pace and his reading of the game. You know, he covers for a doggy and Romero around him. He makes such a difference to that team. So he's back. That's great for Spurs, but they're still missing, yeah, Maddison, Bissouma, Sarr, Son now as well. and Kulusevski missed this one. And that was where they fell down, was in the final third, where a lot of their potential opportunities fell at the feet of Brennan Johnson, who's, I don't want to dig him out, but he is pretty much front and centre of Spurs' attack. He's the one that's charged with creating these chances. And that final pass, that smart decision, just isn't quite there yet. I don't think Spurs were expecting it to be there at this point. You know, he's still only 22. I think he was expected to be mostly a bench player this season. But he started somewhere between 12 and 15 games in a row now. And we're just not quite seeing that improvement from him yet. He's not quite taking it up a step. And I do have sympathy for him. He's as Daniel will be well aware, he's used to playing in a counter-attacking team. And now he's very much front foot, lots of the ball, got more time in the final third to think about those decisions. It's just not quite there yet. And that's mostly where Spurs fell down.
Meantime, one player who has really come to life under Ange's Richarlison is now on 6 goals in 6 Premier League matches. What's behind that change?
I mean, he had a couple of months away. People will remember in September he was seen crying on the subs bench away with Brazil on international duty after he'd missed a guilt-edged opportunity. And he'd had a few weeks of that, of missing chances for Spurs and Brazil. He'd been carrying an injury for quite some time, and they decided to take action on that. And he had surgery on a groin issue. But I think a bit of a break's done him good mentally, just as much as physically. And you can imagine Ange Postecoglou is the type of manager to really take the pressure off and be like, you know, come on, mate, don't worry about that. Let's just get back to doing what you enjoy doing. And I think we may see something similar with Timo Werner. There were some promising signs there. Again, it's a very initial look at him. But yeah, Richarlison sort of looking like his old self now. And that's great news for Spurs, because they were having to play Son down the middle, which isn't his preferred position, albeit he was doing quite well there. And yeah, he took advantage of Man United's astonishingly bad defending at corners. You know, they conceded that goal. Romero hit the bar with a free header from 3 yards, which Onana just watched. And they had another couple of wobbles as well. United is so bad at defending from corners. So yeah, Richarlison certainly looking back to his old self, and that'll be a key thing for Spurs in the second half of the season, because they haven't got many goal scorers in their squad.
He got the first equaliser after Højlund had scored seconds after the game had begun. And the second came, as you mentioned, from Bentancur, set up by newly arrived Timo Werner. Colin?
Yeah, the United set pieces have been attacking as well as defensive. They're just not a threat from them at all this season. But this game last year was when United beat Tottenham 2-0, and that game really should have been a lot more of a clear-cut scoreline than just the 2 goals. And I think that was one of the games I think Tottenham fans were thinking, this is under Antonio Conte, was a real, real low. And you see it this season, and again, we've spoken so much about how the kind of the mood around the club changed, the style of play is completely different. But yeah, it was just such a, I mean, it had Tottenham have won this, they would have leapfrogged Arsenal into fourth, albeit haven't played a game more. But
right,
just with all these players who they've still got to come back, obviously they've signed Timo Werner, they've signed Radu Dragosin from Genoa, that they've now got, it feels like they've now got a squad that, and without European football as well, that they can potentially go on a very strong run the second half of the
season. Right, the fact they don't have any European football to worry about, excellent. May well be what United are aiming for next season, who knows. So Jim Ratcliffe, repeatedly shown there in the stands, what would be point one on his to-do list, do you think, that he would have compiled briefly? Because you say we're always doing Man United. Was there anything from that game you think, well,
I mean, I do think there's a lot of individual promise. I think you see Mainoo and Garnacho, who are two very young players who I think, if not already, are very clearly on their way to the top if they, say, injury-free and keep the same sort of mentality. But I think Rasmus Højlund as well. I think Roy Keane was saying before the game that, you know, you can only give players so many opportunities. But I think that's maybe a bit harsh, in the sense that this is a guy who came in, he's 20 years old. United spent a lot of money on him, but they don't have anybody else in that position, because Anthony Martial's essentially not there this season, as is so often been the case. And I think United really missed a trick last summer, not just bringing in a backup striker, even in the sense that last year the sort of much derided Weghorst came in. And whilst, you know, it doesn't need to be a player you spend a lot of money on, it just needs to be a player who you can trust to sort of be part of the game and to sort of settle in quickly. And they haven't done that this season, so there's been a lot of pressure on Rasmus Højlund, but I think you see today his attitude's really good. He does have a lot of ability, and I think he makes the players around him tick a lot better. And I think that balance with Rashford on the left and Garnacho on the right does work from an attacking point of view.
Would you? You'd like to see a Vogt Veghorst, a Fellaini style January sign, just to mix things up.
I honestly think that it would be a good idea, yeah, in the sense that United are very hamstrung by FFP at the minute. A lot of clubs are, but I think they could do a lot worse than just bringing in a short term solution until the end of the season.
All right, 2-2 then. Charlie Eccleshare pointing out this is the third big away game for Spurs this season. The others being at the Emirates and the Etihad, in which they have twice been behind but still managed to earn a draw. So very impressive characters, is Charlie. Excellent. There you go. They are now level, Spurs, with Arsenal, although behind on goal difference and the fact that Arsenal have a game in hand on them. As for Man United, they are lying seventh, 8 points off the top four. All right, Daniel. Next up, we'll be talking about a game that I'm sure you were all over. Game of the round. One of the games of the season, particularly for quality of goals, and that is Newcastle 2, Manchester City 3.
For most of us, January means New Year's resolutions. But for the footballing world, January means one thing. Transfers. There's a lot going on, and to stay on top of every move that matters, you need the Athletic Football Podcast.
They were prioritising somebody like Mason Mount.
5 days a week, we'll help you cut through the noise with the most reliable reporters in the industry. David Ornstein, Adam Crafton, Laurie Whitwell, and many more will not only tell you what the deal is, but how it happened too. So make sure you don't miss a single transfer beat in January with the Athletic Football Podcast. Listen for free wherever you get your shows, and hit follow and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
That's a great ball, is De Bruyne looking to shoot. Oh, he scored! Such an elegant finish from such a good player. He simply passed the ball into the back of the Newcastle net.
Toys away, everyone. Daddy's home. Daniel, Kevin De Bruyne's back.
Yeah, it really did feel like that. I don't know if it's because of De Bruyne's slightly muted personality or sort of lack of superstardom, but he's the best player in the Premier League, and he's started one game in all competitions this season away at Burnley. And you know, I know Manchester City haven't been perfect, and they certainly haven't been smooth over the last couple of months, but I think everyone kind of slept on just how much of an impact he would cause. I didn't expect it to be this quickly off the bench and in quite so emphatic a way. But you just look at the way every other Manchester City player makes runs, that they know that pass is coming. The goal was just outrageous. I don't think there's anyone else who can... Like, he didn't hit it hard, and he hit it from miles out. And yet at no point was the keeper saving it, at no point should the keeper have saved it. It's kind of hard to work out, but just that pure technique of the pass and the shot. And it's one of the very few times we've seen Guardiola sort of step into Mourinho celebration territory, that late winner. Obviously, it was an important goal of itself, but just that kind of statement of having De Bruyne back playing those passes. And yeah, I think having seen that last 25 minutes, I think it's, you know, I don't think it's inevitable that City now romp to the title, but if De Bruyne stays fit between now and May, I don't see how anyone can stop him doing what he's been doing for half a decade.
Although a lot of teams beating Newcastle of late. De Bruyne coming off the bench with 20 minutes to go. City at that point were 2-1 down, a goal and an assist later, and it was 3 points for the champions. We should talk about the goals, because I suggest it's game of the season, rather, in terms of just sheer quality. Five of them. I'll play the which was your favourite game. Tim, which was your favourite?
Earlier today, it was Bernardo Silva's.
Okay.
It's a very good-looking goal.
It's lovely,
it's gorgeous, isn't it?
Isn't it?
It's not quite Kanu versus Middlesbrough, but it's in, you know, that's the best of its genre, I would say.
Would you say? Because I've seen people say that this was the best of its genre.
So?
It's a lovely genre, and this was a particularly outstanding example. Colin?
Brian Roy away at Spurs in 94-95, 4-1 win for Forest at Spurs, which was so good that for Spurs fans behind the goal stood up and clapped. It was a beauty.
Right. Colin?
I really enjoyed the Oscar Bob winning goal.
Oh, no, but we're talking about which was the best kind of deft back heel flick.
Oh, the best deft heel flick. Yeah, the Canu sort of.
Really?
That's the most memorable. Someone stands out in my memory.
Distance, and no one expected him to do that.
Now Dixon eventually on the overlap. Kanu! So impudent, it's almost unbelievable.
Just from right at the edge of the box.
Okay.
And then, yeah, a little instep.
But
it.
This was pretty good. And at the earlier today, you felt that, yeah, this was the best thing.
Yes.
But now...
And then I've seen an interview with Kevin De Bruyne in German, which had subtitles, thankfully. And he was kind of saying, they asked him, did you deliberately pass the ball through Fabian Scher's legs? And he's kind of explained it a bit. And he said, it's not a coincidence. It's well thought out. Scher is making himself look as big as possible because he's been isolated. He's the only defender, so he's trying to make himself bigger. So he says, so I know his legs will be further apart. So I've tried to shoot the ball through his legs,
right.
And then that makes it difficult for the goalkeeper to respond, and I've focused on precision rather than power into the corner. So it's nice to hear that explanation. You don't get that very often.
But what if Bernardo Silva told you about what led his...
But he hasn't.
He hasn't, has he? See, now, I agree with you. I love that first one. Colin, what was your favourite of the five?
The winning goal.
Oscar Bob.
Yeah, the footwork was fantastic. And to have that composure in the last minute of the game.
Well, that has the amazing assist from KDB. Mm-hmm. And then the wonderful 1-2 shuffle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing. All right. Daniel?
I mean, my favourite is De Bruyne, but let's give Newcastle some love. Isaacs is my favourite of the two, the way he opens up his body. He's so good at doing that. He's like, you know, if we saw on Sunday Marcus Rashford, they're kind of, you could blur out everything else and it would look like a Marcus Rashford finish. Exactly the same with Isaac, and those ones he opens up and hits. He actually hits them high as well. He chooses to hit them high rather than low, which most players are taught to do. Gordon is an example of that later in the game. Yeah, I love that Isaac finish.
Magnificent. Newcastle with two goals in just over 2 minutes, actually, as they responded to the wonderful Bernardo Silva opener. And for all the run of bad results they've been having, it was a very credible performance, the way that they responded to going behind against City. You know, there were positives there.
I think this is a matchup that actually suited Newcastle quite well from an attacking point of view. Anyway, and we saw this last season in that 3-3 draw at St James's Park, whereby they are very direct and intense with their forward press. And I do think if Man City do have a weakness, don't they, defensively, when teams do that, albeit City created plenty of chances themselves, but it did feel like the players like Anthony Gordon, players like Alexander Isak will cause that City defence problems, and they did. And you sort of felt whenever they got those two goals in 3 minutes and had the crowd behind them, and I think for Man City to come back from that, it does feel like a moment, doesn't it? Even despite the form Newcastle have been in, and it's with De Bruyne coming back into the team. And it was after the Huddersfield game in the FA Cup, and when De Bruyne came back, and Guardiola said, you know, it's players like De Bruyne that win games. We can be playing well, but we won't necessarily win. But if you have somebody like that, or like Haaland coming on,
right.
They're just decisive, and that's exactly what happened here. Just somebody who, and you saw not just with the De Bruyne goal, but with the Bob goal as well, where he set it up, just how much time he found and created in that central area of the pitch. I mean, there's very few players can do that. And okay, you can maybe say Newcastle were tiring at that stage, and you know, so they maybe dropped off slightly, but to give him that room and for him to find that time and space, you know that he's going to hurt you. And that, I mean, De Bruyne is the best player in the Premier League, and he has been for quite a while.
He's played 44 minutes in the Premier League this season and now has one assist, obviously. That's more than Antony. And it's the same as Luis Diaz, Diogo Jota, Willian, Gabriel Jesus, Cody Gakpo, Leandro Trossard and Saïd Benrahma.
Oof. So they got him back and they're capable of scoring three of the finest goals we've seen this season. And that's without even the world's deadliest striker in their ranks. So it does look a bit of a concern. They do have a slight issue about Ederson, who picked up an injury on an early Newcastle attack.
I was just going to mention as well about Oscar Bob.
Oscar Bob,
who's obviously sort of come onto the scene. And we think that whenever City sold Riyad Mahrez last summer, and they were sort of quite willing to do that. And even Cole Palmer, who's been fantastic for Chelsea, of course. But Man City still have Bernardo Silva in that position, and Phil Foden can play in that sort of position out in the right side of attack. And for Bob to be coming through, that's another player. So I think his emergence really kind of underlines why they were so open to those sales last summer, which maybe surprised a few people at the time, that they do have that depth there, even if it's not apparent. The players they have coming through are of a very, very high technical level, and he's just another that's come in and looks right at home.
I received a bit of stick from a listener to this show earlier this season. We were talking about Man City's lack of squad depth, and there were some weird names on the bench, and
right.
I said Oscar Bob, who no one had really heard of at the time, sounded like a silent movie star from the 40s. But ironically, he did sort of dance like Charlie Chaplin with his little shimmy, shimmy tap dance for the winning goal. So I feel like, you know, we should pay
tribute. There you go. Dave Tickner on Football 365 says that Oscar Bob has now entered the pantheon of players can only be referred to by their full name. Although I noticed, Colin, that you just called him Bob.
It's very much of a Joe Hart.
Yeah.
Everybody always calls him Joe Hart.
Joe Hart, yeah. Xavi Alonso, Jonjo Shelvey, the other examples from Dave Tickner. Oh, and he says, get Harvey Barnes to shuffle up a bit and make some room. There you go. Dan, your story.
I was just going to say about Newcastle. I saw a number of Newcastle fans, it's not the first time I've seen it, talking about Eddie Howe's kind of game management. They did sit really deep in that last 20 minutes, and it wasn't until really late on that Howe even made his first substitution. I think it was 86th minute they made a change when City had already scored one and were kind of swamping Newcastle. And it has become a bit of a pattern for Howe. I look back at other games, and they squandered a lead at Wolves, and he waited until the 72nd minute to make a change, and Wolves had scored by that point. He waited till the 89th minute against Everton when Newcastle lost 3-0 and Everton had scored twice just before he actually made that sub. And then against Liverpool, he kind of made an attacking change when Newcastle scored to make it 1-1 and didn't make another one until they conceded. And I think there are some questions there. I know the bench is really thin. They had like five defenders, two goalkeepers and a couple of kids. But that was crying out for players to kind of kill the game. Like Matt Ritchie was there, Dummett was there. These are kind of bodies and energy and effort more than quality. But they kept that front three on and they barely saw the ball in the last half an hour. They didn't have a counter-attacking threat. And I just, yeah, there are a couple of questions about that. I know Newcastle fans will kind of be looking out for it now. It's also the first time since Eddie Howe took over they've lost two in a row at home. He was kind of appointed, you know, they lost two in a row and then he was appointed. That was ostensibly why eventually he was appointed as, or the previous manager was sacked. And yeah, I don't know. He's being dealt a pretty difficult hand with injuries, but so are most managers at the moment. And I think there are just ways of, you know, he said after the game, look, if we'd have got a draw, it would have been fine. And look, we got it wrong, but we'll learn. And I think, yeah, he just kind of isn't learning over the last three or four times this has happened.
Yeah, this one against Man City, but it's, six defeats in seven now, which is a rough run.
They've also conceded 18 goals in the last 20 minutes of matches this season, which has obviously been in the Premier League. There's been a lot of them, but obviously in their Champions League group as well. The late goals against Milan, the late equaliser at PSG, those not seeing out games has killed them this year. And as Daniel says, that's about reacting in matches. And last season, they just had such a strong defensive record. I mean, it was pretty much the best defence in the Premier League. Whereas this year, I mean, obviously the XG figures at Liverpool were one thing, but it does seem that they're certainly away from home more than at home. But even against City, it felt like City deserved maybe three goals in that match. Has created so much. And just quickly to finalise this on Man City themselves, this felt not big, not just in terms of the result, but looking at their sort of run of Premier League games that are coming up, they've got Burnley at home, they play Brentford home and away, they've got Everton at home, they've got Chelsea at home, they've got Bournemouth away and Manchester United at home before going to Liverpool on the 9th of March. So that's a lot of points that they could potentially pick up there. And we've already seen that they have gone on a slight winning run now. And they are the one team, aren't they, who you think, if you're going to put money on somebody to put together 9-10 wins in a row, it probably will be them, as they do most seasons from January onwards. So,
well,
yep.
It's true, isn't it? Not been mentioned much, but they do often go on big runs of results in the second half of season. We'll find out. For now, they are 2 points behind Liverpool as they head off for warm weather training in Abu Dhabi. You mentioned Chelsea in that run of games which awaits them on their return. Chelsea, who have been putting together a bit of a run themselves. 4 wins in their last 5, the latest of which coming Saturday lunchtime when they entertained their friends Fulham at Stamford Bridge. A 1-0 win courtesy of a penalty just before half-time scored by Cole Palmer. Chelsea have been awarded the most penalties in the Premier League this season, 8 so far. Raheem Sterling winning lots of them. Yes, Daniel.
And Fulham have conceded the most penalties. Ah. They've conceded 14 since the start of last season, which is a fairly ridiculous number.
Oh.
I kind of looked at Fulham They're a really frustrating team because they do lots of things really well. And then one of the things that seems to sort of undermine them is these kind of penalty box brain fades. They've also scored more own goals than anyone else this season. And it's like they're sort of 95% competent and then 5% clown show. And it's like, it must be so frustrating for Marco Silva because that challenge for Mr. Diop is brainless. It deserves to lose you a game. And they aren't prolific enough, albeit in a weird two-game spell against Forest and West Ham. They don't create enough chances generally, particularly away from home, to give away one of these every now and then. Six penalties this season they've given away, and they've all been scored against them.
There you go. Fulham down in 13th. Chelsea now find themselves 9th. How about that? Top half.
Yeah, they're much closer to Europe than I thought they were, actually. They're only,
how close, Tim?
Well, 1 point off 7th.
All right.
It feels like baby steps, really. It felt like they'd kind of given up on this year. You know, like when an F1 team sort of stops putting any money on its current car and just starts building towards the next season. But it feels like they've actually got something to play for this year. But yeah, it's Liam Toomey wrote in The Athletic that the atmosphere at Stamford Bridge felt like it was one mistake from mutiny, which shows you how sort of perilous it is. And I guess, like with Man United, any victory just seems like, you know, keeping of the peace rather than building any sort of momentum. But yeah, they're pretty close to Europe at the moment.
Excellent. So that's Chelsea, Fulham. Next up, we're due to talk about Everton, Aston Villa, Daniel. So steady yourself for that. And we'll get on to the big news that could be breaking on Monday, with big minus points being handed out to Premier League sides, so they say.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Daniel, you made potentially your last ever trip to Goodison this Sunday for Everton 0, Aston Villa 0. No goals. There was one disallowed from Alex Moreno in the first half after lengthy deliberations. And then there was that Dominic Calvert-Lewin moment when he was through on goal and then, yeah, Emi Martinez, basically, yeah.
This is the most played fixture in English football history, and I think we probably need to have a bit of a meeting and get our heads together and kind of say, well, maybe it's just been too much for a while. Should we sort of leave it for a couple of years? It was. I've got a mate, Chris, who supports Villa, and he sort of said, we're talking about the game afterwards, and I sort of said, you know how you say a game didn't really deserve a goal? Like, this game didn't really deserve a corner. It was really bad. It was just, like, these are good quality players and there was a lot of industry and effort in midfield, but just so many bad final balls and overhit passes and kind of groans from Goodison. It's a decent result for Everton. Villa will consider themselves annoyed not to have created more chances, but Everton did have the best chance of the game in Calvert-Lewin going through on goal, and Emi Martinez had made a save kind of sort of 10 seconds later as well. They just didn't really create enough. I think Ollie Watkins got a yellow card for using the arm on James Tarkowski, and I think Tarkowski sort of played him a little bit. It felt like Watkins was too interested in that personal battle than and kind of distracted from the job in hand. And yeah, for a team that whose games are almost kind of be like Tottenham's recently, where you think, well, we're guaranteed fun because Villa are playing, I guess it's credit to Dyche and Everton that Villa had very little fun.
Okay, the point leaves Everton 1 point ahead of Luton and the bottom three. Luton, who on Friday evening drew their fixture 1-1 away at Burnley. A lot of talk about how important the first 5 seconds are in Luton games, but the last seconds were pretty important too. Carlton Morris popping up with his first goal in 14 league appearances in the 93rd minute to equalise for the Hatters, much to the chagrin of various Claret's dignitaries, including JJ Watt, who is, I read, a former NFL star and a minority investor in Burnley, who tweeted, "To miss this," this being the supposed foul on Trafford in the course of that goal, "to miss this on the field and miss it on VAR is truly disgraceful." Was it a foul? Was it truly disgraceful to allow the goal?
It seems like a... I was certain it was going to be disallowed.
I was certain it wasn't.
Well, same, yeah.
Well, I think that the Luton players thought it was going to be disallowed, which told the story for me. I mean, they bet it
was that not just VAR fatigue? That
maybe, but it, a 92nd minute equaliser, you know, a huge goal for them. You expect a little bit more. It felt like they knew. To me.
Do you think it should have been disallowed?
I mean, he does move himself towards the keeper. And
the keeper moves himself towards him.
But he sort of looks at him as he's turning around and barges into him. And he definitely impedes the keeper. Yeah. I'm surprised it wasn't given. You know, we know how much leeway is given to goalkeepers.
Right.
It felt like a championship decision in a championship match to me.
Saturday evening then, match of the day, they broke down the guidelines on this, which pretty specifically said that if two players are pretty much doing the same kind of motion, that the goal that it shouldn't be a foul. And that was why I thought it was actually valid. Daniel?
Yeah, same. I thought there is a movement from the Luton player, but Trafford's charging out. And I think Trafford realises before the contact that he isn't going to get there, and therefore he thinks if I make contact, if we come together and I go down, then I'm going to get the foul. And I agree, I was quite surprised it wasn't given because of that reason. I don't think it should have been. I certainly don't think, I mean, I know, again, we're getting into kind of murky VAR chat about clear and obvious errors and is there enough to overturn, but yeah, I didn't think it was. I mean, it certainly wasn't a complete disgrace, but then everything's a complete disgrace now. So.
Was the point a piece? Was that a fair result, do you think, Colin?
I guess so. I mean, you talk about the decision. I don't want to get dragged into VAR or anything like that, but Burnley just concede too many late goals. They do. This is another... And it feels like they're a soft touch to play against, whereas Luton... It feels like they're in every game. It feels like they're... I don't know if it's more perception than anything else, but it feels like they're not an easy side to play against. Whereas Burnley, they had that 1-0 lead against West Ham, conceded twice later on. There was a late Villa winner again. There was a bit of bad luck in that. They conceded points against Bournemouth and Brighton quite late on. I think it might just be a question of players maybe just lack that bit of self-belief more than anything else. And yeah, I mean, the goal could easily be disallowed, but it's just the defending wasn't great to allow that situation to develop in the first place. And yeah, like Luton get another point. They've beat Liverpool. Not Liverpool. They drew with Liverpool. They beat Newcastle. They only lost by one goal against Arsenal, against City, United, against Spurs. They're in every game, and it feels like they've got a spirit about them that Burnley don't, and that might put them in pretty good stead for the second half of the season.
You mentioned about belief and Burnley, or a lack of it. When they came to Molineux to play Wolves recently, they had a big poster on their dressing room wall which said "Believe" in big capital letters. I think maybe they'd blown the lead to West Ham a few days earlier, lost 2-1 at home or one of these games. That's obviously their problem. I mean, they lost that game 1-0 and didn't look like they believed they could win.
Right.
So yeah, that's clearly the issue.
Even though they had a poster that said "believe."
Even though they had a poster, it didn't work.
I mean, they literally told them to believe before they went out there. Yeah. Sorry, Daniel.
I was going to say, the really interesting thing about Burnley for me is that over the last 6 or 7 games, it seems like Kompany has pivoted to do what he said he would never do, which is compromise on possession. I mean, at the start of that last championship season, when they weren't doing as well, didn't start the season that quickly, he sort of said it'll always be possession. That's the way I've always been taught to play and manage. But you look at their last, you know, their first 14 games, they were regularly getting 55, 60% possession. Over the last 6 games, you look at it, 28, 32, 34, 36. They had 70% possession when they played Luton at home in the Championship, and they only had 39% on Friday night. So that feels like a deliberate move. And I guess Kompany feels like it's their only shot at staying up to do something different because it wasn't working. But it also makes him less secure, I suppose, because if you then change to sacrificing possession, and everybody thinks, well, we might as well get the kind of firefighter manager in to do that.
Yeah, so, particularly if it works better.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
All right, well, for the moment, they are 5 points from safety. However, a big boost to their survival chances might come on Monday, with rumours flying this weekend of further FFP sanctions for some of their rivals. Wolves have been mentioned, although Tim's very much poo-pooing that story. Forest and Everton, the likely candidates we're hearing on Sunday evening. Forest, who are currently 4 points above the bottom three. Everton, who, as I mentioned, only a point better off. For FFP breaches, you'll recall that Everton have already been hit with a 10-point penalty. That was for the period 2019 to 2022. The latest round of penalties, if they come, will be for the year 22-23. But again, for failing to keep your spending within a certain parameter. Mm. Well, Tim, we're a little bit hostage to fortune because many people will hear this maybe after the news is broken, but what is it likely going to look like?
Yeah, expecting developments on Sunday night into Monday with Everton and Forest being the two key sort of protagonists here. I mean, Everton displayed such indignation at their original ruling, this 10-point penalty, that it would seem surprising if they're going to get done again to the same extent.
Well, they're busy appealing the first one anyway, no?
Yeah, absolutely, hiring hotshot lawyers. And certainly seems confident from within the camp that the points deduction can be maybe downplayed or overturned or whatever. So to be done again will be an enormous blow. Hmm. And feels unlikely. Daniel will know more from the Forest point of view, but it seems like those two are certainly in the firing line at the moment.
I think one thing that we can say with confidence as well is that regardless of any definite outcomes, at FFP is maybe not doing the job everyone wants it to do, but it certainly is having an impact. And there's a lot of managers have come out this month, for Unai Emery with Aston Villa, and even Enzo Maresca, the Leicester City manager in the Championship, saying that we can't sign anybody due to the regulations. There needs to be players out before players come in. And like even Newcastle fans saying, you know, why can we not spend even with the owners that we have? And it's like, well, you look at how much money they have actually spent in transfers in the past couple of, 12 to 18 months, and there's not really been very many outgoings. So the fact that that is in place to be like, well, you just can't infinitely spend by justifying it through revenues. And even Arsenal, Tottenham,
Manchester United saying they can only have two loans this month.
Yeah, and these are clubs who've got incredibly good revenue streams, incredibly strong revenue streams, but there is at least some form of regulation. Maybe it's not enough, but it clearly is having some sort of an impact across the board.
I think the one thing we can be sure of from the Forest point of view is that if they have broken or are deemed to have broken the rules or are charged with breaking rules, that they will try and fight any punishment. I don't think we need to get necessarily too wrapped up in the 10 points that we've had for Everton and assume that's going to be a kind of across the board thing. There were issues, or there were the judgment with Everton was also around like maybe misleading, and it was the greater time period, not just the 1 year. So, but it's going to get messy. It really is going to get messy. And you know, one of the interesting Forest, for example, have one argument, which is that, well, we could have sold Brennan Johnson before June the 30th for 30 odd million and have definitely passed these rules, definitely not fallen foul of them. Are you telling us that it's more financial sense to sell a player for 32 million than it is for 47 million 2 weeks later just because of a line in the sand? That sounds ridiculous, they say, and you can kind of see the point there, although they knew the rules. The Premier League to that might say, well, you didn't have to buy 35 players last season. Yeah, it's going to get messy. And I think whatever happens, we're going to see some fairly significant legal challenges from clubs. And I think it's probably also fair to say that the clubs who don't break it but are very close would also like to see a relaxation of those rules to an extent.
The other thing that does need said about FFP, and I know I just sort of praised it, but the fact that it encourages clubs to sell young players that it develops, I'm not sure that is a good impact on the sport. You look at like Chelsea, are the clearest example of that, right? It's like so many talented youngsters who they've developed and they've grown through, and they're ready for the first team, and fans are angry that they're being sold off. And we've looked at the rumors, even with Conor Gallagher, who's been a very important player for Pochettino, yet the club seem to be quite open to allowing him to go just purely so that they can make additional signings. And it doesn't seem to be that.
But it doesn't
good
force
thing.
Them to do that. It's just their desire to replace their homegrown stars with.
Yeah, but it does reward clubs for selling players who they have developed, right? Rather, because you can cash that in as pure profit rather than players who you've actually spent money on. So that I get it from an economic sort of regulatory point of view, but in terms of the actual sporting benefit, which is what this really should be about, I don't think that's a particularly good aspect of it at all.
It does effectively, and I like football clubs to operate as sustainably as they can, but it does enforce a pretty emphatic glass ceiling for promoted clubs to the Premier League. it makes it very difficult unless you have a kind of masterstroke owner, which is basically just Brentford and Brighton over the last 10, 15 years, and that's about it. And that's a very long-term plan that came from a point of sustainability and then overspending in the Championship to have a plan in place for the Premier League. It's very, very hard for promoted clubs now to compete with clubs at the top without spending above those limits, because the limits are lower for a Championship club than they are for a Premier League club, and your losses in the Championship count towards the Premier League. If there was a kind of year dot when you get in the Premier League and it was 3 years rolling for that, I would get it. But it's very, very hard to come up and compete without doing that.
Mm. All right. Suffering particularly with points penalties of late, you'd have to say, a Reading. We might touch on events with the Royals, particularly after a dramatic weekend for them. Among the many things we'll be touching on next, including Tim's trip to Darmstadt.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Dramatic scenes this weekend at the Select Car Leasing Stadium, name at Aitken. League One game against Port Vale for Reading. Halted on 16 minutes. It had already been held up once earlier on when the traditional tennis balls were thrown on. But this time around, when around 1,000 supporters made their way onto the field, the game was suspended. I think I've got those events in the right order. But basically, yeah, the fans forced the game to be suspended. Part of their ongoing protests about the absentee Reading owner Di Young, whose mismanagement of the side or club has seen them docked a total of 16 points through various different judgments since November 2021. Greg Double tweeting, just got to take a step back and realise this is Reading, not Millwall, Leeds, etc. We're a club that used to be sponsored by Waitrose, that when we play Fulham, it was called El Middle Classico. We are this angry because we are terrified of losing our club. And you can understand it, they're down in the relegation zone of League One.
Yeah, I'm going to Reading on Tuesday to meet some of the Sell Before We Die, which is the Reading kind of campaign group. It's a woeful situation. As often happens in these situations, their initial protests, which are absolutely valid, have only kind of hardened the owner's stance, which is completely unhelpful for everyone. And yeah, there is a real risk of Reading going into liquidation here if an owner refuses to sell and would prefer to kill the club out of stubbornness than sell it, then protest is the only way. The one thing I'd like to say that I thought was really good is that the Port Vale fans, who travelled a heck of a long way to go to Reading and could have been a bit annoyed that they hadn't seen their team play a football match they paid for, were, it sounds like, almost 100% supportive in terms of like chanting and congratulating Reading fans and sticking with them. English football fans are typically really, really bad at this sort of unity stuff. Way, way, way behind Germany on it and Scandinavia on it. But here it seems like the kind of message has got through to everyone, which is great.
Right. I think there was some kickback after it became clear that the game wasn't just going to be interrupted, but actually suspended, that the cries of "we want our money back" and that kind of thing.
I was just going to say, along those lines, I mean, great to hear Reading's manager, Ruben Selles, formerly of Southampton. You know, you think, you know, he's the most senior authority on this that's going to speak over this weekend from Reading Football Club. And he basically just said, you know, it's their club. As in the fans, it's their club for life. You know, obviously we want to play matches, but we understand their frustrations and they can make their point, which is not necessarily what you expect a manager to say. But
Danny, you mentioned the owner, the potential that he might just decide to let the club die rather than sell it out of, I mean, almost spy. But how much did he invest in the club? I mean, how much did he actually invest in the club? And would it not be a massive loss for him?
Yeah, it would be. It would be a huge loss. And there is no argument to do it other than spite. And the hope is that this protesting will lead to some sort of mediation, which the EFL has been prepared to do previously and I'm sure will be prepared to do again. Try and get people round a table and try and get the owner to understand that it's in everyone's best interest. This is not a salvageable situation. It's not in anyone's interest for this to carry on. But it's hard. And in the meantime, to do that, you have to kick up as much of a fuss as possible. That campaign group has been around. I think I first interviewed them about 5 months ago, 6 months ago, maybe even longer. And you know, Reading fans were protesting before that and still nothing's happened. That's the problem. This has been going on and on and on. And all the while, Reading just get worse and worse on the pitch. As you say, not helped by these semi-regular points deductions.
Well, they're already in the relegation zone, 3 points from safety. You'd imagine a points deduction potentially from this as well, essentially forfeiting a game.
Right.
It shows you that obviously the strength of feeling is about far more than points and divisions here.
Caterers have left. They're eating microwave meals. The players, the staff are wearing overcoats inside because the heating's turned off, etc.
Yeah, completely desperate situation. Yeah, there's a piece on The Athletic outlining all the miserable details of it this week.
Mm.
And it's worth bearing in mind just quickly that this is an extreme example, but it's across the EFL in particular. There's a lot of clubs who've had very, very negligent ownership, which have really, I mean, these are these clubs are community institutions. It's not just the fans who it does belong to, but there's so many people who are involved in terms of their pay slips and their month-to-month living that to have that security that just this style of reckless absentee, pretty much ownership, inflicts upon them. It really is really, really bad. There's no other way of putting it, and it shouldn't be allowed to get to this point, but it has been. And I think football needs to look at itself a little bit as well in terms of just how can this be allowed to happen, whereby somebody owns a club and just does not care.
I have total confidence football's going to take a long look at itself and immediately take measures to make sure this doesn't happen anymore now that it's been brought to their attention. Let's lighten the mood, Tim, by talking about what you got up to on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Off you go.
Went to Darmstadt to watch the relaunch of Jadon Sancho's career. His first football for almost 5 months. Yeah, I think he made three fairly brief substitute appearances for United in August before his social media post and all the fallout from that. So yeah, travelled across to freezing Darmstadt just south of Frankfurt. Darmstadt, worst team in the Bundesliga, at home to Dortmund, who were just as bad in what was an awful game. And we weren't expecting to see too much of Sancho, considering his lack of football, maybe a little 5 minute cameo at the end. But yeah, in the 55th minute, on he came. And he did pretty well, actually. And
set up Marco Reus for the second goal?
Yeah, he was rusty, obviously. But yeah, he did set up his good pal Reus for the second. And looked, you know, pacey, direct, positive, got an assist, making things happen, you know.
Big grin on the face.
Yeah, but you're just watching him thinking, why is he not done this at United for the past year. I know there's lots behind that, and it's not just him, but it adds another layer of, you know, absurdity to why it hasn't worked out for him at United. When
some people would say physically there are different demands in the Premier League, and that's why he struggles.
No, of course, but you know, a cameo off the bench. He's so good with the ball at his feet. He's so positive, so direct, so pacey. He can do something for United,
right? It's, and a United team which we've just seen without people who can make things happen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I know it's not just one person's fault and not just another, but the fact that it's come to this. But anyway,
yeah,
good for him. He looked different. He looked happy. He was waving to the home fans when he was warming up. He was posing for selfies at full time. And he didn't speak to the lowly written media, but he did speak to the host broadcaster briefly after the match and said, you know, he said how happy he is on a number of occasions, and he said he's home. And it just looks a much better fit for him. So hopefully, because, you know, there's a wonderful player here.
Yeah.
And you can imagine the next 4 or 5 months are going to be very good for him.
It was a 3-0 win for
Dortmund.
Yeah. The first goal created really by another exciting young Englishman, Jamie Bynoe-Gittens, who surged up the right flank, beat a couple of men, and then put the ball in for Julian Brandt.
Yeah, first time I've seen Bynoe-Gittens in the flesh. Looking forward to watching him. And that was the only, he produced the only moment of quality in the first half to help him break the deadlock. And in similar form to Sancho, he plays on the right of a front three. And again, very pacey, very direct, and got a lot of promise. The two looked like they're chums as well. They were hanging out after the game.
Oh, nice. Okay, because one replaced the other. And then the third goal, Daniel's got his finger in the air. I'm sure. Is it to talk about Moukoko, who scored the third goal and looked absolutely sensational?
No, it was to talk about Bynoe-Gittens, actually.
Yep.
I interviewed him at the end of last year, and he talked about, I mean, he had a heck of a time in Germany. He moved basically when he was 17, 18, maybe even 16, and then COVID hit, and he had basically 18 months of dealing with that, and then he got injured for 4 months, and then he got very infrequent minutes. In the meantime, he learnt German fluently. There's an amazing, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's an amazing interview when he first went to Dortmund, and someone had obviously grabbed him after a game and said, Sky Sports interview, and he was like, Sky Sports, I know Sky Sports, this is fine. Went to do the interview, and it was clearly Sky Sports Germany, and the first question was in German, and he just sort of stared down the camera and just burst out laughing as if to say, I have got no idea what you just asked me. And he's really shy, but he looks to be doing incredibly well there. We underestimate so much how hard it is. He moved abroad at 16, yet knowing none of the language, and remarkable to settle down. We talked about Sancho settling down. He was Sancho's mate, so the hope is that, you know, he's got his mate back as well, and they look after each other, and can only be good things for both of them and Dortmund.
Excellent. We'll hear more about the Schwarz-Gelben in Tuesday's Totally Football Show European edition, when Rafa will be in with James Horncastle, another big weekend in Serie A. France is back. Julien Laurent will be telling us what's happened there. And Alvaro too. Tim.
I was just going to say, this is my first ever Bundesliga game.
Yeah.
And within 2 minutes of walking in the stadium, I walked past Lothar Matthäus.
No way!
I was
like,
does this happen game. Every game?
Yeah.
But yeah.
With the welcome mat. Very nice. What will they be saying about Sevilla in the European edition of the Totally Football Show on Tuesday? Colin.
Not overly complimentary things, I would imagine. I pointed out on Friday night, they lost at home to Alaves. They've only won 3 games across La Liga and European competition this year. They somehow aren't in the relegation zone. They're still one place above that, but that might change in the next couple of weeks. They're just really in bad form. Kike Sanchez Flores is their third manager of the season. As many managers as wins, that's right. And this is a Sevilla who are a very old squad. You got Jesus Navas, 38, Sergio Ramos, 37, Rakitic is 35, and they're still key players. They're trying to bring a couple of youngsters in this month, including Hannibal from Manchester United and a couple of others. I'm not really sure that's really...
I wonder how he'll be making the journey down, you know, through... No, but anyway, are they more likely to have another manager or another win this season, do you think? Win,
well,
probably.
I would you'd say you'd like to think a win.
Yeah.
But there was a lot, I did notice when I put that up, that there are a lot of Leeds United fans really don't rate Victor Horta very highly, who's the sporting director at Sevilla after being at Leeds for, I think, 6 seasons. Now, to be fair, he did inherit a really... quite dreadful situation.
From Monchi, the supposed transfer guru. Anyway, more of that kind of thing in Tuesday's show. Also to look forward to this week, well, of course, there's the Asian Cup underway and AFCON 2. And there's FA Cup third round replays. Woohoo! We're almost kind of out of time here. But Tim, I know there's one that you're going to be particularly keenly following.
Yeah, Wolves v Brentford, third round replay, has suddenly become Wolves' biggest game of the season. Some fans legitimately saying, and I kind of agree with that, because the prize for the winner is a trip to, I can't really say their name, but a team that plays in blue and white stripes.
The Baggies.
Yeah, those guys. Yeah,
right. Yeah, yeah. But how long is it since you've had a Wolves West Brom game?
We had two in the pandemic, which, as we all know, those games didn't count at all.
Right.
So the last time we played in front of fans was 12 years ago. And it was a memorable game. They won 5-1 somehow. And Mick McCarthy got the sack the next day. So it's been a long time coming.
Been a long time. And to earn that game, you have to beat Brentford at Molineux. That's on Tuesday.
Yeah, they're in a terrible run of form as well. So,
Brentford.
Yeah.
But they got Ivan Toney back, so.
But not for this one.
Oh, right.
I imagine because he wasn't eligible to play in the first game.
Oh, of course. No, so, he wasn't. No, yeah. I mean, that's totally right. That's totally right. Eastleigh play Newport for the right to host Man United. Daniel, was there a third round replay that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, probably that one. Yeah, I speak for myself, Nottingham Forest, and everyone present that we probably do without Blackpool Forest. You know, the club is looking forward to the replay when the manager says we should scrap replays before the replays even happen. Forest are in the very fortunate position that Brentford have also got a replay because they play each other at the weekend and only a point separating them. It's a fairly big game if we've been talking about FFP and such like. Forest probably need as many points as they can get, maybe, and Brentford away at the weekend is a big one. Mm. I know I joke about regularly about Dr. Forest, but it's come as no surprise to me that even Tony will be enjoying Forest in his first game back.
Yeah, well, we shall see. We shall see. All right, well, Tuesday, the European show. Thursday, we'll have our reactions to any midweek stories and looking ahead to the other half of this round of matches from the Premier League. No doubt other stories too. For now, it's many, many thanks to Daniel Story, to Tim Spears, to Colin Miller, to Liam and producer Charlie in the booth, and you, listener, as well. Thank you so much. Hope you have a great week. And we'll catch up with you soon on The Totally Football Show.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.